Welcome back to Missing. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing pretty well, Tim. I'm very much looking forward to the people listening to this episode and hearing the reaction of this guest that we have on, this very special guest. But before we get to that, you know what's missing here, Tim? How you're doing. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, Lance. Thanks a lot for asking. You know, I love speaking with David Robinson. David is the father of Daniel Robinson, who went missing in the summer of 2021, specifically June 23rd from Buckeye, Arizona. And David Robinson has been searching pretty much since Daniel went missing. And we met him recently at CrimeCon. And this is now our second conversation with David. And we get a little bit deeper this time.
We do. Relentless, inspirational, and incredibly motivated to assemble a community not only to help find his son, but to help other parents. He almost immediately recognized the need that families have when they have someone who's missing in their life, and all other resources have sort of dropped off. Law enforcement drops off. Landowners don't cooperate. He immediately identified these needs. So coupled with his search for Daniel, he is in the midst of starting a nonprofit, a 501c3 nonprofit, the Daniel Robinson Foundation. So keep your eyes out for that as well.
Make sure to check out pleasehelpfinddaniel.com and follow the mission on all their social media platforms. You can find so much information on that website. The story about Daniel, how he went missing, all links, YouTube videos, flyers. You can become an ambassador in your city by just connecting with David, and you can help spread flyers if you'd like. You can also text your address information to 803-200-7994, and you can become an ambassador that way.
And something that'll take you just a couple of minutes is going to this website, pleasehelpfinddaniel.com, click the link, sign the petition, and that link takes you to change.org, and it only takes just a couple of minutes to sign this. And the purpose of this petition is to change Daniel's investigation from a missing person to a criminal investigation, and that change has to happen within the Buckeye Police Department Division. That investigative status needs to allow them to use evidence obtained to seek warrants.
And you can submit your tips through that website. You can also submit anonymous tips. So you can text or call anonymously. That number is 844-602-0660. So make sure to follow us on social media, and please follow the Please Help Find Daniel mission on social media as well. There are links in the show notes.
And check out all of the shows that are within the Crawlspace Media Network at crawlspace-media.com. We are also partnered with Glassbox Media, and check out what they do at glassboxmedia.com as well.
Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of The Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
Gather round, friend, and join me by the fire. I have a secret to share. When I was a child, I lived with my grandma. She allowed me to watch Unsolved Mysteries. Fast forward to 2008. My freshman year of college. A series of armed robberies on campus escalated into a serial rapist's reign of terror. That's when I created my first crime podcast. In January 2014, I picked up the podcast again from my college roommate who fell for an underage girl online, to the chilling story of a murdered nun in 1969 Baltimore, and in the throwaway series, I share my own journey of overcoming homelessness and how that experience led me to unmask a serial killer and identify three of his Jane Doe victims. This is Foul Play Crime Series, where the stories are real and the truth is waiting to be discovered.
Welcome back to the podcast, David Robinson. How are you today, David?
I'm doing okay. How about yourself? Doing okay here.
We're doing really well. We want to thank you for coming on. I know what you're doing is really difficult, but I got to just say right off the bat, you came on, you're smiling, you seem motivated, you seem positive, and we spoke at CrimeCon in the hallway, and you came across the same way, and it's inspiring. And I know that it's just a terrible tragedy to draw inspiration from, but I just want to put that out there. Whatever you're doing, however you're conducting yourself is, again, inspiring. So thank you for that.
I really appreciate that, sir. Thank you.
Oh, don't with the sir.
it's a military thing, you know. All of that comes out, you know.
I totally get it.
Yeah.
Well, I couldn't agree more, and thank you again for coming back on the show. And I know a lot of other family members of missing people hear this show as well, and it's inspiring to us to have you here, but it's inspiring to families and people who haven't been touched by tragedy like that.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. So how has your search been since we met you at CrimeCon?
Well, you know, as you may know, I had to put a pause on the desert searches, the organized searches there. That's because of funding and some other issues there that I've really been very responsible when it comes to the love I have for the volunteers that come out there. That don't stop me as an individual to go out and do some things in the desert on my own. So I'm constantly still doing things where I have to, do investigative stuff out there in the desert on my own. But at the same time, I'm concentrating on mostly of getting the forensics done on this vehicle behind me and also the clothing and everything that wasn't done at the scene. So that's my concentration is there. And also, as I was saying before, the 501c3 Daniel Robinson Foundation that is coming up also.
Great. And that nonprofit that you're starting for this, at what point did you decide that that was where you needed to go?
You know, as you can imagine, just by, just looking for my son, I'm bombarded by a lot of other families who's gone through similar situations. The times that when my searches, we're finding human remains out there in the desert, a lot of families are reaching out, you know, concerned about their loved ones. In turn of those events, just talking to the families, hearing their stories, I heard people who have family members missed for 5 years. And the way they're explaining those stories to me, it's not like it happened yesterday. So I know that very well, that feeling, because every day for me is like every day starting over day one. So I know they are pain. I couldn't be human if I didn't respond to that. So I was able to respond to that, wishing I could do more. I know what I have been going through since I started coming out to Arizona to search for my son. It was very hard. Didn't know who to turn to, how to get any help, how hard it was just to get media coverage. So that gave me a passion and a drive to help other families not to go through the same thing. So that became the birth of Daniel Robinson Foundation and the fact of my son's name. He's a very, very intelligent young man. He have high dreams and hopes. He want to do some things, entrepreneurship. I just go on because he's such a great, great young man. And this inspired me to make sure in honor of his name, the Daniel Robinson Foundation will be born to help other families, because that's exactly what he would have done if he's right here with me now.
And please do. The floor is yours. Please go on. Tell us about tell us about Daniel.
Sometimes I can get long-winded, but you know.
It's fine.
Yeah.
So, my son, you know, like I said, very, very bright young man. One of the things I miss the most is, he's very inquisitive. He comes to me and asks me a lot of questions. About things in life. He's always asking something, always asking advice, always wanting to do something. He challenges not only us, but he challenges himself. I gave you guys the background, his story growing up. He was born without one hand. You can rarely ever, we just have to point those things out, but you'll rarely hear us talk about it in his successes. That's because he lived his life like that. You have to physically look at him, just staring off. But he's such a lively person that you kind of forget that he was born with one hand, because he does everything and anything he wants to do. So, like I say, he inspired me with that. He's a very friendly young man. You know, our family, you know, dynamics, well, we may have some little, anything that may come kind of like a little wedge, he'll get between that and bridge those things back together. And so that's his Daniel's nature, very much nature, very well missed by his family and friends. So of course, I'm doing everything I can as a father. First of all, he's my son. He's a Robinson. He's my son. And I want to make sure that his well-being has been taken care of.
And did Daniel have a lot of friends growing up?
Well, you know, my ex-wife during the time, his mother, we kind of sheltered them somewhat, I can say. And some of those reasons because of the things that how we had to grow up. We grew up in circumstances where we had to be careful. So we don't try to be mindful of our children. We made sure they was in certain schools, for instance. We kept them away from certain things. To make sure they stay focused on educations to, you know, you name it. The typical thing that parents would try to do to get the best of our children. Having that, but most times Daniel and his siblings would have friends from school, you know what I'm saying? In school, that's where they had their friendships. We didn't see too many of them coming around the house and we didn't have them spending the night and things like that. But once Daniel got in college, for instance, my daughters, they all went to his twin sisters and him went to school around the same time. And they always often come to me, man, Daniel, he's always partying all the time. Have all these friends, everybody knowing we walk down the street, they already always call his name out. Very popular around the College of Charleston. And but one of the things, of course, as a parent, I'm worried about his education. But yeah, he has a lot of friends based on what I've seen from college until now, coming out of when he's missing.
And does Daniel have a lot of friends in Arizona? And does he have some geologist friends as well and coworkers?
Well, only one coworker I know that he's a friend with that he goes out with and hang out. I guess you guys probably can read the report and know who that person is. Outside of that, he did have a few that come in town to visit, or he went to New York himself to go visit his friends. So generally the ones that he do have is out of town now once he got out of college.
And once he got out of college, he immediately went to work. Can you give a little background as to the path in which led him to the job that he had before he disappeared?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, I always had to put this out. Daniel graduated with honors. You know, he went to take a class in Flagstaff. Right out the graduation, I didn't understand the way they did this thing, but he had to take a class for his graduation somehow, even though we had the graduation. And so he went out to Flagstaff. They flew him out there to do his final class. And then once he was doing that class, he did have a friend. I want to back up a little bit. He did have a friend of his in a fraternity, one of his best friends in college. They were one of the founders of that fraternity. His family owned the company, Matrix New World, Matrix Southwest Groundwater. His parents owned that company. So when Daniel was in Flagstaff, of course, I think through that, that company hired him on straight from that class. So Daniel didn't ever come back to South Carolina that we thought he was anticipated after that class. He just went straight to Phoenix and then where he started his career.
Has there been any update in the official investigation since we last spoke with you?
Well, you know, as reluctantly, I have to say, you know, I don't really don't have any real information from the Buckeye Police Department in terms of, you know, I just hear rumors or things like that. They put out in the public that they're investigating. But as in coming to the family, and they don't give us any kind of information about anything. But I can say on my behalf, yes, there are some new leads there that came out. Some of those things just literally was in my comment section. Now, you know, I'm doing a lot of interviews and doing a lot of stuff on YouTube, for instance, and some comments people put there. I don't get to look at the comment section as much, but it was brought to my attention by my team. And so I was able to start investigating. I did report those things over to the Buckeye Police Department. Of course, they're law enforcement. At the same time, you know, I conducted my own with my investigator. We currently checking those things out.
I just want to get back to the job real quick that Daniel had. How much did you know about what he did on a day-to-day basis there, and can you share what that was? I personally, when we spoke at CrimeCon and we were talking about that, I find it really fascinating, and I also think that it sets the sets the table for his disappearance. I feel like people really need to know the circumstances of his job and what he was doing on a daily basis.
Well, you know, I didn't find out the details of that until I went to go search for my son out there in the desert. His coworkers actually educated me while we were always out there searching. But what I'd known, Daniel often called me from the job site since he had that job. We'd talk for 2 hours every time. A lot of times, like I said, he's at those well sites. What I have learned is that Daniel, his assignment is to go out to these various well sites, no matter where they are in Arizona. These sites are generally always in the desert, and it is always involving some new community that will be built and things like that. So in Arizona, what I found out is they have to have wells in these communities, I guess, in case of a water shortage, they have to have groundwater. Daniel's job is to visit these wells. He's a scientist himself. By law, these wells have to produce at least 100 years of water, and his job is to determine that. Once he determined that, he also gets samples from those well sites, determine what type of rock sediments in that water. They had to know what content level of, I guess, acidity and things like that of that rocks that's in those water. Make sure it's drinkable, to make a long story with that. That's Daniel's job. Like I said, from his job, like I said, he's a field geologist. So he could just get assignments. He gets assignments on his computer. They say, hey, he gets up every morning. I do have his phone, so I do know how his alarm work. Gets up in the morning, he have his coffee, look at his assignments, and then they give him directions, a mapping. He go to those locations where he'll meet a representative from whatever that drill company is at the time. That's every time. And from that point, he's there most of that day. Sometimes it's at night to get those water levels.
Okay, so he'd go out and meet folks in the desert. Okay, by the wells.
That's right.
Is this considered a dangerous job on any level?
Well, our families are from our opinion, yes, I think so. You know, one of the things that was very disappointing for our family, my auntie in Philly, she called that company. She was raising hell. Excuse my expression. I hope I can say that. But she was really uptight. One of the biggest things is that we learned. That generally the field geologists at that company often are by themselves. They go out to these locations alone to meet one person out there or so and in these areas. Now, what I'm saying is they don't have the protocols there to say to make sure that the employee made it to this destination or going to make it to that destination, that to provide so many things of their own just to make it to these locations. The safety aspect to me is not really good. And the fact that just like what happened here in my son's case, he's going out there in the desert, an area that he has never visited before. I know he's a geologist. He loves hiking and things like that. But, you know, still, yeah, it's ultimately can be dangerous. It depends on the situation at the time.
Yeah, of course, because one can enjoy hiking, and hiking is one thing. But when you're collecting samples and you're paying attention to something aside from like your foot position, and you're doing something else, you know, that's it's a little different. Especially if you're dealing with the terrain and the sun and any sort of, I guess, rattlesnakes. I mean, I don't know what's right in that area, but there's so many other factors that you're dealing with. And when you're hiking, you're kind of looking for those things. But when you're working, I think maybe your guard's down a little bit.
And that's true. Daniel, you know, he had to wear a hard hat. I do know he had that. You can see here behind me on this picture there on the ground. It's his safety vest. He had to have the safety vest. Just typical same thing we would do at a construction site. These guys are drilling. Sometimes I guess he go there in some instances where he go to these sites, they are just drilling those wells. And of course they have to have those safety features there because they have these big cranes up there. You know, something could fall, a crane could fall, anything could happen out there. Like I said, as in for the terrain and the elements out there, very hot. My son always carries a canopy. That's one of the things you heard about. He left at a young lady's house. He used a canopy to keep the sun off of him, for instance. Also, yeah, the other hazards out there in the desert that we learned just by going out there. You got the mountain lions that live out there. You have, you know, other wildlife, snakes, like you said, scorpions, whatever the case may be. We do have wildlife out there. So they generally stay away from humans, of course, but, you know, they are out there.
And we spoke a little bit about Daniel's car last time and how it was found. Can you just talk to us a little bit about what was found in the car? And I understand his clothes were found outside the car and his wallet as well.
Oh, that is correct. Right here, you can see behind me, that blue area there, that's the pile of clothing. Daniel's, allegedly, the reason why I say allegedly now, because of course on my investigation, we had to determine if that indeed is Daniel's clothing. I still haven't proved that yet. But allegedly that's his clothing in a pile, the pants are turned inside out. We do know there was a wallet there with his identification in it, some of his cards, debit cards and things like that. But the wallet itself was empty with no cash or things like that. One of the things also is the cell phone was found inside the vehicle. The same cell phone the family I was calling Daniel's phone at least almost a full day, a little over a full day before it finally started going straight to voicemail. I guess the battery died. Inside the vehicle also was his hard hat. The hard hat was filled with rainwater, almost to the rim. Also, there's a his keys and things like that, his work computer. That he get his assignments on, that was in that vehicle also. So little items like that, some other little small items, but like I said, a case of water, two cases of water, untouched water inside this vehicle, stuff like that. So yeah, there's a lot of indications of some people want to think that maybe he had changed the clothing, but we don't have those evidence either. So we're looking at every aspect we can.
Okay, yeah, tell us a little bit about the rainwater found in his hat. That seems a little confusing to me.
It is very confusing to me. It was brought to my attention by the Buckeye Police Department. They did give me pictures in the vehicle where you could actually see the rainwater. I can tell you just by the weather report, it was when this vehicle was found, it was just well into getting just about to get into the rainy season, the monsoon season in Arizona. At that time, weather-wise, there wasn't any significant rain happening. But this hard hat was filled with water. The hard hat was located in the back seat. The only puzzling part for me is how the water got in the hat. Because, you know, we do have a busted window in the driver's door where rain, if it was rain, it can come down in there. But it was in the back. Like I said, everything else was in the back, was intact. It wouldn't have came through the sunroof. But nevertheless, there's some rainwater, water. Inside and fill up that one hard hat, but no water anywhere else in the vehicle.
So is this like a traditional hard hat where it's kind of like a bowl?
Pretty much. It's just like a regular hard hat. You see construction. This has Matrix New World on it. White hard hat.
Yeah. Sorry to get hung up on this, but it is really interesting to wrap your head around. There was no other rainwater that was found in the vehicle?
None at all. And one of the things that from my investigative standpoint, I would believe that it was also, in my opinion, put there to just kind of distract and say, hey, this vehicle is sitting here for a length of time and collect the rainwater. And the reason why I say that, because, you know, the vehicle here is in what is called a ravine. You can see the little gap that's under this, the vehicle there. That's a stream. That's where a stream of water runs through whenever the monsoon season comes through. A lot of water come through there. It goes down to what is called the Hassanapa River through the Waginaw Wash area south of this location. And if a lot of water was coming through that wash and that vehicle was there, and it was raining that much, there would be almost like a ring. If you look at your tub water, I don't know how nobody uses tubs anymore, but let's say you're really dirty and you have a ring around a tub. It'd be collecting a lot of that debris and things like that. So that vehicle would have that ring around the top part of there near where the sunroof is because it'd been blocked because it'd been stopping a lot of water and debris that goes through there to make it down to that river. And we don't have none of that. So that was before the rain season. It's before it really rained. I did have testimony from a rancher who found the vehicle who lives out there. There was no significant rain ever happening up to that point. So it's still a puzzle why that hard hat was filled with water to appear that it was rainwater.
Yeah, and the car is on its side.
It's on the side, that's correct.
So it's not like the hat was probably sitting in the back without rainwater, and then like it didn't have the rainwater and then it rolled. It obviously would have fallen out. So somehow after when it came to place like that, that's when that's really interesting.
And how did you get that information? Was this like on the police report?
Well, you know, they gave me the pictures. This picture right here, for instance, came from what Buckeye Police Department gave me. So that's where I was able to do some of my own. I had to put my own investigative hat on. And my investigation is totally different than Buckeye Police Department. Like I said, they determined the water in the hard hat is rainwater, and it came from rain. I determined it's been put in that water, that water been put in that hat to throw off as if the vehicle was sitting there in some significant rain. So I look at it in two different ways.
That is it's a head scratcher.
Yeah.
And very much so, yes.
Did the police, they stopped a helicopter search at one point? I heard you on a video talking about that.
Yeah, and it was heartbreaking. That was the point of me making it out to Arizona quick, like I did. You know, I didn't want to believe my son was actually missing. I was hoping that they would found him quickly, find out what's going on before. Either way it would happen, I was being coming out to Arizona. But like I said, the day he went missing, I did put in a missing person report. Later that night, found out that he was actually indeed missing in the desert. I did ask them to go out and fly out there and look for him, because explaining the reasons why. They told me it was nighttime. They couldn't do it, of course. You know, I had to suck it up in a sense. Stayed up the entire night, but they said he was going to do it early the next morning. So I said, okay, I'll suck that up that night and just do other things until they're able to do that search. But like I said, the next morning, an officer, Haley, took over from the night crew. Officer, and he said, hey, yeah, Mr. Robinson, we're going to have the helicopter. We're getting the helicopter out there to search for his son. I'm very happy at that moment. And then they called like an hour later and said, he called back and said, no, the flight was canceled. It's unauthorized. His higher ups, he said, it wasn't me, but my higher ups said that Daniel is a grown man. If you want to disappear, he can't. And that's the reason why they canceled the flight. Hearing that automatically let me know that it was not going to search for my son. So I had to make it a Phoenix as fast as I can and do it myself. And that's why I was there.
And speaking of the search, are there geologists from other departments, other environmental groups that have volunteered to help with the search? Because I would assume that they know the terrain, even park rangers. And on that, are there any rumors like in town, specifically within like those environmental, like that environmental company community?
When I started my searches, I have, it started off with sometimes we have like 200 plus people out there helping the searches, and they do come from different ranges. I did see some people, never in the groups and in the full groups like the biker groups or the hiking groups and things like that. But it'd be individuals that may say, hey, I'm also a geologist. Of course, there were some people from Daniel's job that showed up. I don't know if it was a company mandate, but at least about 8 of the workers there geared together and came out to support my searches. So, you know, I was able to talk to some people who have skills as in from hiking themselves, but I haven't found anybody except some of the local residents there that knew about that terrain and that part of Sonoran Desert. And but they were out there too to kind of assist and give me some information about the desert itself. Cause, you know, of course I'm a military guy. I know we have to do our recon, and I've been doing recon before I started my searches. Going out there every day with my binoculars, trying to get a feel, doing some work of learning about terrain and washes and things like that, how that desert out there work before I put volunteers on the ground. So those are some of the things that had to happen. So, you know, so I did get some education from that, from those people once they got there, and also from some research.
Can you tell us, do you know if there were any, if they fingerprinted or if there was any DNA that they've been working with? I know the Buckeye investigation has left a lot to be desired, but I'm just curious about those.
Well, one of the things is, it's simply put, no, they didn't do any forensics work or anything on the scene. This is like, again, this is a picture overlay, of course, of Daniel and stuff. But this is a picture that they gave me. What happened is on July the 19th, of course, the vehicle was found. Here it is, July the 20th. They turned the vehicle over to me, told me if I didn't get out of compound, they would have it towed and I had to pay storage fees. Now, having possession of that vehicle, I didn't actually get it out of there on that day. I did ask the officer to give me 3 days. But I already had a meeting set up with the chief of police, Chief Hall, Chief Sanders, and all of his staff while the vehicle was still sitting in the compound until I had it towed out. In that meeting, one of the biggest things I learned is that because of the one picture they gave me at the time, I didn't see any forensic marker. I'm not, at the time, an expert on things like that, but I do know that most times when police officers are doing any kind of forensics work, they use these orange markers or yellow markers or something to indicate that with the pictures. I did ask Chief Hall for those pictures. This is one of the pictures of those pictures I asked for. He said, I'll give you everything. They did tell me they did helicopter searches. They did the drone searches and also using cadaver dolls, you know, all that stuff. But they did provide me everything they said they had. And that was just the pictures itself. Like I said, none of them had the forensic marker. And I asked them about that. I said, you know, pretty much I had an NAACP member there as an observer to listen in. And also I had a recorded meeting with them. And I asked them, hey, look, why haven't y'all done any forensic work on the scene? The detective sergeant said that because they didn't find any blood in the vehicle. They didn't see any blood in the vehicle. That's how you put it. They didn't see any blood in the vehicle. Well, then that's when my question was, how you know my son was even driving that vehicle? It's obvious he's driving. It's his vehicle. It's the answer that I got. That wasn't satisfactory to me. Made me very upset in that meeting. I demanded immediately for them to do some fingerprinting on that vehicle. They did agree to that. So they was able to keep the vehicle even longer, just a little couple of days longer to do those fingerprints. So that's when the fingerprint, if you guys look on the report, that's when the fingerprint was done because I requested that. And then after that meeting, of course, they gave me everything on the scene in evidence bag marked for safekeeping, told me to take that with me. And then after they did the fingerprinting, I did have that vehicle pull up with my private investigator.
I didn't realize that law enforcement needed blood evidence before doing forensics.
I didn't know that either. You know, like I said, I'm not an expert, but, you know, one thing for sure, I would think they would at least, what I was learning now, especially from my private investigator, is that most times they would do all the forensic work on the scene. They have to. And then he said they should have never, ever even turned those things over to me for safekeeping. And as Daniel's going to come back and grab his things, you know, that should still be in some type of evidence locker. And the vehicle still should be stored in their facility at this point. Yes. Just in case. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And we had a listener who heard your interview that you did with us from CrimeCon, and she has a friend who either worked or still works or is in like the management level of another environmental agency. And she remembered his stories about, you know, some of the jobs that they would do. And she was surprised at how competitive that industry, at least on his end, was. And she had emailed and said, can you make sure that you ask David if there were any known rivals or if it was a competitive industry or any sort of contracts that companies were competing for? There might be an opposition, maybe development of that land, maybe something being surveyed. Was there any sort of anything like that going on at the time?
Well, you know, I hear a lot of rumors. I hear a lot of things from some people that live out there. And from my research, I did find out on my own is that area out there they've been trying to develop that area since the 80s. And some of those reasons is because of the groundwater. It's because, like I said, they have to have that 100 years of water. And some of the reasons, some other development issues. So they've been trying for a long time. I do know Howard Hughes having this big city that's coming out of there called a smart city. So they're dumping millions of dollars out there. There's some little talks about the Douglas Ranch out there and some little issues with that. Those guys are having fights over the land, which part is really their land and things like that. So, you know, it's a lot of rumors and things I hear going on there. But the only thing I can pinpoint, like I said, is they've been trying to develop that for a long while. And if my son was to have, and I know my son is a young man who does his job well. You know, and if he believes in something, he's been taught that way. You stand up for what you believe in. And one of the things is, I know he's going to look out for people. If he found that those wells would not produce, for instance, 100 years of water, he would say something. And I know my son would do that. But, you know, that will stop a project by law. They wouldn't be able to build a so-called smart city. So some of those rumors would be like, hey, what if, that's some of the reasons why he went missing. I do not know. I don't have any evidence of that. But that's some of the suggestions and things like that, theories that's out there.
What about the FBI? Has the FBI had any involvement in at this point?
Well, I did talk to, of course, in my searches, we've been finding human remains out there and bringing some closure to families. I did send a letter out to Chief Hall. Of course, you guys know I've been fighting for the FBI for a long while. One of the things is when I wrote that letter, wrote a long letter, CC'd Senate managers, to the mayor, to you name it, in this letter, my attorney. And in this letter, I described the fact that Chief Hall went on to CNN to say, hey, my son went missing. This is a suspicious nature. And when he missing, suspicious nature. Also the fact that, again, my son went missing in what I call in that letter is a crime scene. These are human remains been found at a skull, been found not far from this way the vehicle was found there, human skull there. It's a big crime scene. And so I thought the FBI should be looking into that. Not including also that at the time, I didn't know, but I assume, but it was definitely close to BLM land, Bureau of Land Management, which is federal land. I thought the FBI should be involved. So make a long story with that, Chief Hall did agree. He said, hey, you know, we're gonna have a case review. I'm gonna send that to the FBI, have a case review to the FBI. My attorney immediately sent a response back and say, you know, we would like to be a part of that. If she can't be, she definitely, I need to be there as a family member. The department did it behind my back. To make a long story short, I did wait on their response. They never gave me one. But they, when the time came as a response, almost a week later, the detective came to me and said, yes, they had a case review. And the FBI determined that, say, Mr. Robinson, you are doing such a great job on your own. We don't need to come in. They told me that's what the FBI told them. So, you know, they have not came into my son's case. I did find out, I was really puzzled to see if that really did happen because I didn't believe the FBI would say something like that. And I later found out through a team member of mine who have those strings and found out who the agent was. And I did have a talk with the agent who now says, now because of hindsight now, I found out that my son's vehicle right here is indeed on federal land, is on BLM land. I did talk to him about it. That agent, and he says, it's Buckeye's jurisdiction. And I said, no, I don't get that. I mean, it's on your land. So when that, no, it's Buckeye's jurisdiction, their job. And that's the way it stands right now. So I'm still going to fight, you know, to make sure I get the FBI involved.
Can you just back up a little bit? Because Tim and I had the same expression going on, the same reaction. Who is it that said to you that the FBI said, no, we're just going to leave it to him because he's doing such a great job?
Well, it was a detective. It was a detective of Buckeye Police Department.
The detective of Buckeye said that he spoke with the FBI, and the FBI actually said to him, "Ah, oh, the father of that missing person is doing a great job, so we're not going to get involved."
Right. The way he was doing it, he was relaying what was told in the meeting to me. He was telling me what was told in the meeting. Right. That's right.
It's a
maybe
great
I just
compliment.
Watched too many movies or something. Yeah, great compliment. But maybe I just
yeah,
watched
you know,
too many movies.
That was offensive to me. Yeah. It was very offensive to me at the time. You know, here I am relying on donated funds. I'm relying on citizens of Buckeye, a big portion of Buckeye citizens out there, relying on them to even come out there to search with me. I can't search a desert by myself. It's very offensive that because I was begging law enforcement for certain equipment like specialized drones, camera equipment that can go down in these wells and mines, and these vertical mines and things like that. And I can't get no help from law enforcement. And then for them to say that at the time, you know, just saying, hey, look, I'm hearing that from them. Yeah, it offended me. I know I'm not great as FBI. I don't even have the resources of the FBI. And so it was very offensive, but nevertheless, that's what was told to me. And I don't want to accept that, just think that the FBI would actually say that.
Yeah. So speaking of drones, and I apologize if you already said that and I missed it, but you mentioned that you're asking for drones and the camera equipment that can go down into, can explore different areas. Have you had any companies volunteering that? Have you done searches with drones and camera equipment like that?
Well, you know, I try to reach out to nonprofits who have those type of drones. I did purchase a drone, finally purchased a drone for my desert searches, but it's not a specialized drone. It's something I can use just to survey the area and keep the volunteers safe. I like to fly it ahead of us and see what we're coming to when we do line searches, things like that. But the drones itself, I was unable to get some of those nonprofits to come out with their drones. And also the Buckeye Police Department, of course, they didn't bring anything out. But as in when it comes to searching those mines and wells, did locate a couple mines, probably like five of them now in close proximity to where my son went missing. These are vertical mines. Some is unmarked mine. They don't even know they exist, some prospect mines. Very dangerous, very scary, going straight down in the earth like that. But the thing is, I did want to get those things searched. I did reach out to the Buckeye Police Department again with the letter with my attorney and to have Chief Hall send those officers out there to help me in these searches. Of course, they came empty-handed like they did one time before, but we did meet. I was able to meet with them about almost a week and a half later out there in the desert on a weekday and to try to search these wells that my son, one was when my son was last seen and one north of that. They did come with someone with these cameras. These cameras was, I tried not to sound like a police basher or something like that. So I tried to make sure I didn't put it out, but I was really disappointed. They came out with two things I asked for was cadaver dogs and also cameras to search these wells. They came out with some little fluffy little, I thought it was a household pet, to make be honest with you. I don't know what it's, I can't say what cadaver dogs really are, but it's really cute little fluffy white dog. They said the dog didn't alert on anything. And then they had got this, some guys from Maricopa Pet Sheriff Posse or something they call themselves, came out with some type of camera that they outfitted themselves. They went down into the well north of where not the one my son was missing at, but one north. I went down with those cameras. Those cameras went to the water level, barely touched the surface of the water level. And they pull out and they're saying, hey, that's pretty much it. They was really upset that the camera got wet a little bit. That was unacceptable to me. I didn't say anything to the public, but I went behind the scenes and got my own person to come in and made some arrangement with the companies, with the owners of those wells. Those owners didn't want us in the wells, but I made a center. The center was to have the company I'm working with to come in and give them a free well inspection. And so I can get these wells checked. And that, so it's a win-win for both of us. They allowed us in. They made sure I had an insurance. So we had to do that kind of deal. Make a long story short, was able to get a company, a real company, to come in. And we submerged those cameras in both of those wells. One was 800-some feet. One was close to 1,000 feet deep after the water level. And we made it all the way to the bottom. I do have a question about the one north. There's appeared to be something there. I'm having an expert to look at that. Something that looked like the top of a skull, but we're not sure it's been buried. We do know a large amount of dirt been dumped in there for whatever reason, a lot of stuff that shouldn't be down in there. Those are things that are being searched, right? Going to be been taken care of now. I'm working on behind the scene to get that taken care of and looking to see if somebody indeed buried something down in that well. But like I said, that's real detective work. That's real money that I had to do myself, things I had to do myself, and I'm not getting from law enforcement.
Whew. Well, good for you to figure out a way to like backdoor that.
Yeah, it's good problem solving. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I sense that might come with your military training, is how to problem solve.
You know, yeah, a lot of that. That's right. How to. And also, you know, my son, you know, he's my son, and I'm going to do everything I can. I had to be very thoughtful and you know, just take my time. And it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of work and, you know, researching and things like that and try to figure things out. I'm always constantly, you can probably imagine, always constantly thinking of different ways I can find my son, look out for my son. So.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com. Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
There's the matter of the mileage that is registered on Daniel's Jeep. Can you explain any discrepancy that is going on there with the mileage?
Well, my former investigator, he was able to find that. You know, it's crazy because when the Buckeye Police Department gave us everything, like I said, they gave me that vehicle the day after and threatened if I didn't get it out there, gave me the clothing marked for safe keeping. When I hired my investigator right after that, the first thing he did was to go up and want to know about this black data that was pulled from the vehicle. He made it up to the Buckeye Police Department to ask them for a copy of that. They gave him a copy and told him they didn't have an investigation. Here's everything. They gave him everything they had because they say they're not investigating. They have no more leads to follow, is what they told me as well. My investigator was able to read their data that they pulled. It's either they didn't know how to read it, or they didn't read it at all, or whatever the case may be. But a lot of that came from the data that the Buckeye Police Department pulled themselves. He was able to read that. With the infotainment system that he had pulled out of the vehicle to have analyzed in California with a 900 page report that came back from it. And it was able to pinpoint a lot of things like the 11 additional miles on the vehicle. And also the vehicle's first initial crash happened 4 hours after my son went missing after the 9 o'clock, of course, around the one. And also, with the first crash itself, like I said, it was driven another, like I said, 11 additional miles after the first crash. So, you know, all that stuff was was right there, but they didn't read it. I was told by the Buckeye Police Department before I brought my investigator in that the vehicle was going 30-some miles per hour, went down a ravine, flipped and turned, blah, blah, blah. And that's it. There was no additional miles. There was no this. My investigator also was able to find red transfer paint on the vehicle. There's nothing red in the desert. So that there's another indication that the accident did not happen here and it happened somewhere else. And in fact, that the rancher that I had interviewed with my investigator who testified saying the vehicle wasn't there 2 to 3 days prior. He was there and it wasn't in his ravine. So it's a lot to that, right?
How long in between when Daniel went missing was the car found?
Well, it was almost 30 days. He went missing on June the 23rd, and then the vehicle was found by that rancher on the 19th of July.
Okay. And the rancher claims that the car wasn't there before, like, say, the 16th or 17th of July?
Right. He said 2 to 3 days prior. And you know what backs it up for me, where I think his story is credible, is the fact that the Buckeye Police Department did a first initial search for my son out there looking for his vehicle almost 3 days after he went missing. And they covered that area where this vehicle eventually is going to be found. They say they did this extensive search, and I have to believe they used a Phoenix Firebird helicopter. Okay, and then almost 2 weeks after that, they went out there again with what is called Civil Air Patrol crew. I was there. I didn't believe the first search they was there, so I grabbed my daughter, and we all went to that area and waited on them that morning to see if the Civil Air Patrol came out. They did. They came out. But some reason they didn't want me to come with them. They made sure that didn't happen. They had one of the Civil Air Patrol guys to post his vehicle at the gate so I couldn't drive through and follow to see what they're doing out there in the desert for whatever reason. But they did ultimately say they did the search of the same area where this vehicle was found, eventually going to be found, and they came up empty-handed on both of those searches. And like I said, if you to back that up, is that rancher who came after that point on the 19th said that July 19th to say that the vehicle wasn't there 2 to 3 days prior, because he was there searching for his cattle. You know, he's a cattleman, fourth generation, I think he said he was, but that's his land. And he's out there chasing his cattle. His cattle always come down this ravine. South of the ravine is a corral that he gathers his cattle at, and he's waiting on them to pass through there so he can, you know, track them, stuff like that.
The accident that was on the report, I guess, is like a black box report for the car?
Yeah, he was also determined with that black box data is that the vehicle turned over. I don't know if it was a key or push button, but it was turned over 4 to 6 additional times after the vehicle's crash. So it was cranked, at least cranked or turned over 4 to 6 additional times. Somebody just kept cranking it 4 to some times after the first crash.
After the first crash. Okay. And right. Is the second crash listed on the black box report?
No, it wouldn't. The black box would not record that. Once that first crash happened, it wouldn't report anything else from that point. Unless they cleared that that black box, cleared it out, I guess, with the key or something, some kind of way to clear that data out. But for now, he got that determination that it was multiple crashes based on the damage on the vehicle. The damage didn't match this terrain here, this terrain and this ravine. You know, of course, the vehicle did crash because it came down that ravine to hit the bottom, but the damages don't match.
Yeah, I'd also add that I'm not sure why turning the ignition when it's on its side would work.
Would do any good in that situation. Yeah.
Right, right. And, you know, and then, you know, don't want to forget that on examination of the vehicle itself, like I said, I did mention the red transfer paint, but on the outside of the stereo, on the windshields, there's two impressions as if somebody took something out of a bed or threw something heavy into the windshield on both sides, one on each side. The one on the passenger side, whatever it was, hit the crest of the windshield where the metal begins, kind of dented at the end, and they kind of rolled down on that side of the windshield. But all both of them are impressions, as if something was trying to go inward, not outward. So that's an indication that somebody was beating the vehicle also as well.
And your private investigator looked over the vehicle, came to that determination?
Right, right. That's right.
Were there any footprints, any other tire marks, any other sign of another vehicle at the site that the Jeep was found?
You know, when I've heard from the Buckeye Police Department on the 19th, on the 20th, they called me almost over 24 hours after the vehicle was found. And the first thing that this rancher told us in the testimony, he said, the first thing the Buckeye Police Department told him, don't alert the media and don't alert the family. And for whatever reason, that was one of the two things he did. He told the rancher not to tell the family. They did not tell me about this vehicle almost 24 hours after, like I said. Now, one of the things that they told me from the scene there, hey, Ms. Robert, they told me about the vehicle. I didn't give a crap about the vehicle. Where's my son? We didn't find your son. We use cadaver dogs. We use tracking dogs, search dogs, we use helicopters. Mr. Robinson, we use helicopters that was flying so low, you can hold your hands up and you can touch the bottom. The man was leaning out like this and looking down on the ground, searching for your son. And we didn't find nothing. We didn't find no footprints. We didn't find any, at that point, I already told me that everything on his body was on the ground. We didn't find any foot tracks. We didn't find any wheel markings and nothing. No sign of where he went or anything like that. Or somebody, you know, like you said, picking them up. So those were the things that was told to me. But as I'm going out there to search myself, of course, I finally found out where this, they never did take me to the crash site. Chief Hall eventually came down the weekend after the vehicle was found. First time he ever did it. Chief of police now showed up at my search that time. And the first thing he did, instead of addressing himself to me and my daughter, he went to the crowd. He came out grandstanding. Hey, everybody, y'all want to know where this vehicle was found or something crazy? And we all walked. He had walked us to this crash site. He was pointing us to the wrong ravine, pointing us down to some ravine. It didn't look like the one picture they gave me. I was really stunned. But, you know, say, hey, nevertheless, he you know what he's talking about. He said he was there. He started talking all loud about the cartels in that area. And they landed the planes on Sun Valley Parkway at night and all kind of crazy stuff. And then that's when my daughter tapped me on the shoulder, Dad, this other guy wanted to speak to you. And it happened to be the rancher. The rancher showed up there. He put us in the right direction. showed us where the vehicle was actually crashed. I know this was because I remember the stump in the background. And then he showed me the glass on the ground there. That was the time and the only time that I seen Chief Hall at that at the scene. He came in once he heard the rancher correct him. He said, "I don't know why Chief Hall telling you the wrong place." And Chief Hall turned red in the face, walked past, got in his vehicle, and drove off. Both of them have never been seen in any of my searches ever again. However, one of the things I wanted to point out is that it's because, you know, Sam, because of what you were asking there, one of the things is I really puzzled about the scene itself. In my opinion, just looking at everything, it's pretty much, to me, a stage, just like my investigator would suggest.
And who was the last person to see Daniel?
Well, according to the report and according to everything that was told to me when I came out to Arizona and from my son's job, because he went up to this location, was assigned to go there, was this guy named Ken from a company called Weber. He's supposedly being the last person at the time. Of course, you guys probably heard, if you're alluding to that, it was another person that came forward that said that he seen Daniel as well. He was out there target practicing with his kids, his children, and he saw my son through the scope of his rifle. Then he seconded saw him again near what we call as a wagon of wash on the bank. And he went to approach my son, and my son gave him the correct place to target practice. Hey, say my son told him, "Hey, this is not the area that you need to do. We work on this area." But my son pointed him out to the area where he should be shooting. And so that turned out to be the second person who said he seen Daniel. And he also acknowledged himself as a federal law enforcement officer. He even showed me a badge. I dismissed him at the point. I sent him to my private investigator and also my search coordinator at the time. They vetted his story. They told me it was credible. I did mention him in my family press conference, but we later found out he's not a federal law enforcement officer. I did check with the Buckeye Police Department this year in January, talked to Detective Biffin about it. He said they vetted his story because they did do an interview with the guy and they said, "Hey, his story is credible." But I asked him about the federal law enforcement agent line that he's an officer. They said they have nothing to do with his story. They believe his story is credible. Now, in my investigation, I don't believe his story at all. That's why I don't really mention him anymore. It's because it's one question. My son had never been out there ever in his life. This is the first time he had to even get direction from the worker himself to even get to that location. How he would direct somebody to where to shoot? Hey, this way you go shoot at out there in the desert. He wouldn't know that information. So that's why his story to me is not credible, but to the Buckeye Police Department, it's credible.
Yeah, I mean, unless Daniel passed like a gun range and knew where it was, like, I don't, you know what I mean? And so this guy is out in the desert, just firing his rifle?
And that's what they do. See, that's BLM land where the vehicle's right here located. That's federal land. When we go out there searching for my son, we see them out there a lot. They'll go out there and they'll set up their little, silhouettes and things like that. But they always shoot against because it's hilly down and things like that. So they shoot up against something. But they are out there talking to practice officers. There's no range out there. No established range and things like that. They're just people go out and set up their own little setup and target practice.
So you're saying if that person's account couldn't be true because Daniel wouldn't know where to fire out there.
That is correct. And that is amazing. At all the time, the way I came to that determination is through my Q&A. I do a Q&A. I had a person come in ask questions. On a Q&A, her name is Shiro's Nation. She comes up one of the people there and she asked the question and I thought about it. I'm a logical person. I love logics. And I said, why didn't I think about that? And she's right. And so that turned over my whole thinking and it makes a whole lot of sense.
It really does. And then it kind of even come like raises the question is why someone who is a federal agent would need to know where the target practice area would be in the first place if he's out there target practicing. Like why would that? It just seems like such a weird thing to say that's what they spoke about. Like if you're and you're a federal agent on federal property and you need to be told by a stranger where to go target practice when you're trying to target practice, that just doesn't add up.
And one of the things that's struggling me, you know, he turned over in my eyes from just being a person who's seen my son last as a possible suspect in my eyes. And I hate to put it that way. And the reason why is because his story consisted of, I first saw your son in the scope of my rifle. And, you know, I'm out there a lot, and I know a lot of people out there shooting quail and things like that. I remember one time I went out, we followed the 11 additional miles. My searches are based on some of that too, the science and also that 11 additional miles on the vehicle. And we would go search this area we call the corridor area, where they're gonna have an interstate put through there eventually. And we went in that area and those guys was out there shooting quail. I had my rifle at the time, you know, I'm military. Had my rifle at the time carrying along. We was doing a lot of hiking and in that area. And all of a sudden, you know, somebody powed and you can hear the rounds go over our heads. Of course, I went into my military mode. But like I said, people out there shooting all the time. That's what they do. They out of shooting quail, target practicing and things like that. So for him to have a rifle and say he was target practicing and that he first saw my son in the scopes of his rifle, started making me question about his whole story too as well. Hoping that, you know, he wasn't a person who used his rifle to take my son out or anything like that.
Definitely a person of interest. Definitely presenting a image in your head upon introduction,
right,
that you don't want to have. Like, this is a very interesting way to start that conversation.
Right.
In the scope of my rifle.
I mean, he admitted that he was pointing his rifle at Daniel. Like, you know, you don't see him in the scope unless you're actually pointing the gun.
Right. And the way I took it at the time was that, you know, maybe he was pointed out and Daniel's vehicle came into the scopes of that. And that's the way I was taking it on the because the way he came to me saying he was a federal law enforcement agent, he presented a badge. I don't know what badge is supposed to look like, you know, so I believed it. And, at the same, I kind of believed it, but for some reason, a gut feeling say, something don't feel right. Cause he didn't, his appearance. And I don't like to judge people by appearance, but his appearance didn't set right to me at the time. So I sent him to my private investigator, for him. That's his job. I just need to concentrate on the searches, and that was his job to vet the story. And like I said, my former private investigator at the time vetted his story, told me that, he's indeed a federal law enforcement officer. He corrected me a few times in my family press conference. And I went with that until I found out later it wasn't true.
So from where Daniel left that day to, I guess he was following a certain path. He was following a route. Have you and or your private investigator maybe retrace those steps and looking for where a first accident might have happened, maybe any distress in the terrain or anything?
Well, you know, one thing I was able to do, I can't speak for my former private investigator and my former private investigator now doing something totally different. But I know in my own personal investigation, I did do, and I put it on my YouTube, I did a trace of the story from the guy who last seen my son. One of the things for me that was troubling is the fact that he kept saying, it's not in the report, but the things he said to me with witnesses, I did report that to the Buckeye Police Department. They chose not to include that in the report or include that into the investigation. But one of the things that was told to me by this guy when I interviewed him myself personally, because, you know, as a father, that was the first person I needed to speak with, was a man telling me my son just waved out to him and just disappeared. I need him to look me in my eye and say that, you know. So I was able to get that interview with him. I did my military techniques to befriend him a little bit and let him tell his story. He kept telling the same story, exactly verbatim, how he was telling the officer. And then after that point, he changed his story. He started saying things about how he stayed left of the tracks until he got to the T-junction. He didn't want to disturb him because he know that the police will come looking and this thing is going to come national, it's going to come big. You know, that kind of stuff, why he followed the tracks out west and went through a gate. He went another mile or so before he got out on foot and he went up on the hill. He started painting rocks with red paint so the officer could know where to come to find these tracks. But you know what? What I did is I followed those same as that story he gave me. One of the things I know from being in the desert a lot, those tracks don't just wash away. And not only that, a lot of tracks are there. Often, because people come through those little areas where he was talking about to the well site. People travel that all the time with their vehicles, quads, and all kind of things. So there's hundreds of tracks and seemed like on the ground. And it wasn't that much significant rain at the time when or the day that Daniel went missing. So I kind of went in and replayed this whole scenario and showed everybody how these tracks are still there from months of us being out in the desert. I stopped my searches out there and those tracks are still there. So it's hard to determine which tracks is which and which direction they went and things like that. So, you know, I really had a lot of questions with that. And also showed everybody that if you listen to the count that he told me, it would take you exactly to the scene here. You had to go 2 miles down south to get to the T junction. He followed, like he said, stayed left of those tracks, so he didn't disturb it. He made it to a gate. You had to go through a gate to get into the area to get to this point. He drove another mile or so. Then he got out on foot and he went out up on the hill. On the hill, you had to go up on the hill. On the other side of the hill is this area here. So it's almost like he was giving a story of how to get to this place right here to me. That's the way it was to me. And so I just wanted to make sure people, I point that out, the way that he told me the stories and the story that he came up with, in my opinion, will suggest that it leads you right here to this crash site. But as in the 11 additional miles and things like that, I do not know where it come from.
Yeah, and there's never been any other area that you've seen that could possibly be where a car could have overturned or anything or been pulled out of?
Well, I can tell you this. This had been overlooked a long time, and I used to talk about it a lot. 2 days prior, I think it was like 2 days prior, before the vehicle showed up in this ravine here, I did get a message from my family who always followed the Buckeye Police Department Facebook. I didn't have time to be looking at social media, stuff like that. This one gentleman came on there with a picture of a vehicle that looked similar to my son. This is real blurry picture, but it's the back of the vehicle. And he said, hey, I see this vehicle on the side of the road that looks like the Jeep that you guys are looking for, I guess, trying to get Buckeye's attention. My aunt saw, like I say, they saw it. They alerted me about it. I went to talk to this guy in the inbox, who in turn sent me the picture himself. He told me him and his wife riding down the road. They see it on the side of the road there, smash into this tree line or whatever. To make a long story with that, I did ask him where it was. He gave me the location. I grabbed my daughter. I called the detective, Biffin, at the time, and said, hey, this guy was on there and said, hey, you see a vehicle that look like Daniel's vehicle? And before I could finish my sentence, the detective said, that is not your son's vehicle. I'm like, well, how you know? You didn't let me finish my sentence. And I went and completed my sentence and said, hey, you need to go out and send somebody out there, because it's in Buckeye. I need to send somebody out to make sure it's not my son's vehicle. I had Ethel keep asking him. He said, okay, well, I'll send an officer out there to check it out. Before I can get up, when I got the phone and before I can get my daughter, pick her up to take her out there, with the location the guy gave me, he called back. The gentleman called back and said, Mr. Robinson, he said, I went back out there again. The vehicle is gone. I'm like, what you mean gone? He said, it was there he was there an hour before that, but it was gone now. I said, well, Buckeye said it's going to send an officer out there. He said, well, I seen a police vehicle pass by. So I called the detective right back and said, hey, did y'all have that pull out of there? He still to this day didn't give me an answer to that. But I did go out there anyway. And it's kind of ironic. This vehicle was found on that corner, was seen on that corner that looks just like the back of it, looked like my son's vehicle. And then 2 days later, a vehicle showed up in this ravine out here. So those are things I tried to tie together, that the vehicle probably was there and then was able to make it to this location as my investigator suggested.
How does he evade that question? When you asked him, did you have that vehicle pulled out of there? And you said you haven't received an answer. How do you evade that question?
I get it's not a question they evade. You know, one of the things is they just don't give me the answer for it. He said he's going to look into it, check into it again, and they just don't give me an answer. Just like some of the things that happened, transpired during that time, I had to call the FBI and put a report in myself. The FBI told me they had to be invited by the Buckeye Police Department, and they still haven't followed up on those things. So it's just the way they do things, in my opinion.
It's really frustrating.
It is frustrating.
I'm sorry you have to deal with that, because, I mean, there's really no harm in law enforcement telling you a yes or no whether or not they pulled a vehicle out of somewhere. I mean, there's...
You say he's going to find out about it, and still haven't found out about it, I'm sure. Right.
What's there to find out? I'm so sorry.
Yeah. And do you know if Daniel was having any struggles with his mental health at the time he went missing?
No, and, you know, there's some suggestions of that, in my opinion, no. and my family opinion, no. My son talked to me 2 days prior. It was about 2 or 3 days prior to him going missing. And everything sounded okay to me. He mentioned a young lady that you guys heard about. He never mentioned that he was in love with her. Never mentioned called her a girlfriend, only the fact that, you know, he spent the night there with the young lady. Now, those things, for instance, to me was problematic as a parent. You just don't spend a night over a woman's house you don't know. That's basically my stance on that, because you never know, she have a boyfriend, husband, that type deal. Nevertheless, he's a young man. He liked women, and that's what the facts are. You know, so we're young people. But as in his mental health condition, I have never, my son is a brilliant young man. He never expressed that to us as a family. We had to literally sit in an interrogation room with the Buckeye Police Department, my daughter and I, and try to think of anything that would seem odd and strange about Daniel's behavior leading up to his disappearance. And my daughter, the only thing she can come up with some weeks before he went missing, him coming over to her house and sitting there and staring off, you know, say, oh yeah, he was staring off. I mean, I stare off. I don't know what it really means, but that's the only weird thing we can come up with. And but he was able to put that in their report because of that.
Yeah, I stare off all the time, so I don't know.
Yeah, one thing I want to throw out real quick too, and one thing in that report, and I do have to clear that up, and I often do. I never said that my son was in love with a woman he didn't know. And then my daughter, she's really upset with it also. We both are trying to get them to retract that. Some person told me, say, good luck with that. But definitely, we have never, ever, and I want to make sure the public always know that that never came out of my mouth, never came out of my daughter's mouth.
It's good to clear up. Yeah. Yes. I mean, so many things in these, every missing person story that we cover, there's so much that just gets like, you know, like the telephone game. It's
yeah.
Starts off as one thing, and then, you know, you can simply say something like, my son saw a woman who, you know, he didn't know. He, you know, he was getting to know. And then 14 people later.
It. Right.
Yeah. So it's always good to keep that redundancy going, especially right. if it's yeah. going to, I don't know, take some investigation off track or something.
And so what's next for your searching?
Well, you know, I have to be out there in that desert again. I have to, when I say again, I need the volunteers out there with me. There's areas that we haven't searched yet. You know, my last search that I did before I had to put it on pause, very hard for me. We were doing a line search, and it was a area that we're searching. We only had roughly 20 people, and we did the best we can. And there was so much more of that land that needed to be checked out before it gets to a point where I can rule the desert out that my son is in. And well, I can't totally rule that out ever, but I can say we did a very good job of almost making sure that he's not out there. And so I can be something I can be kind of settled with. It's hurtful because, you know, I had to, like I said, put the pauses, but my goal is now is to make sure that I have the funding. And one of the reasons why I did put a pause on search too is because I have to do the forensic work on the scene. I have to, when I say on the scene, his clothing had to be done. The safety vest had to be done. The shoes had to be done. The red transfer paint, we got to know where that come from. We got to check the airbags that's in the vehicle. I had to get the whole forensic work. This period is his work computer, his personal computer. This all of that cell phone already being taken, one of them. One of the cell phones that my searcher we found near the scene, we don't know if it belongs to Daniel or not. So all that stuff forensically had to be done. That's going to cost a lot of money. So I'm definitely saving up for that. And also the fact of I need to get the forensics done urgently, and the searches need to be done too. So I'm trying to balance those two together. But that's the reason why I have the 501c3 also to help towards that funding for the searches and also for the forensics.
And you're out there on social media. You're out there on YouTube. You're making this search and your investigation very well known. And you have an amazing website, pleasehelpfinddaniel.com. Can you talk about the website, the importance of it, and what people can do if they want to help?
Well, you know, the very most important thing is, you know, from hindsight now, going through everything, I tell us the families, one man, he just lost his mother, went missing in Phoenix. First thing, you do have to put a website for awareness, of course. And so for the efforts of searching. So the best thing for my website is definitely to keep the public aware of what's going on so that I can recruit people to come out and help me in the searches. It's good for fundraising. Of course, you know, you can't run any kind of operation, especially what I'm doing right now, the flyer distribution too, you name it, without funding. That helps also. All the information are there. We have events there. I have an event coming out on the 25th of June, the 25th, a day of remembrance for families. And it's dedicated for families of missing people to come out to this event, bring your tables, bring your flyers, bring your everything, and talk about your family. So that is coming up in Phoenix on the 25th. You guys can check that out on policehelpfinddaniel.com. But, you know, it's definitely there for the public, for the awareness, like I said, to my family. I started off with two websites. It was one just dedicated for my family and Daniel's being missing. And the other one was searchfordaniel.org. That was just specifically for the desert searches. But like I said, I integrated those two together to just keep make sure it's just one, keep it all at one place. So yes, please search, go for policehelpfinddaniel.com. We can also sign the petition. That petition is very important. I don't call it a petition of signature. I call it a voice of people. People standing behind me and fighting for what I believe in, putting the pressure behind on the department, the police department, to do more for my son. I'm advocating for a change in the system. We don't need this 12 or waiting 12 hours before you or more longer to report a person missing. As we know, they even have a show called the first 48 hours. We know that the 24, 48 hours is the most crucial point of finding someone. If they don't act immediately, and within that 24-hour period, then we got a problem. And so, you know, so that's the thing is to try to fight against some of these laws and get some of these laws changed. So all that's working together. All that's working together. Also, one more last thing, I know I've been long-winded, is that I have an ambassadorship that I've also started with the policehelpfinddaniel.com, so they can be aware of that. That would go along with the foundation eventually. Where I have been asking, I'm getting a lot of influx, and I'm asking people right now if they want to be an ambassador in your own city, no matter what city you are in the United States. If you want to be an ambassador in your city, to reach out to me. I will have a Zoom meeting with you all to tell you the ins and outs about that. We want to get the ambassador program where people, it's part of the flyer distribution, where I can get Daniel's story out everywhere, in every city, every state, through flyers. So you guys be in charge of distributing those flyers in your city. And also, like I said, that'll help with the upcoming foundation where those infrastructures already be there.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, very impressive work in your search. I understand how complicated and multi-pronged it is, and I think you're doing an incredible job. Is there anything else you'd like to say before we end today?
Well, thank you guys for having me on. I really was happy to meet you all at CrimeCon. Sadly, on certain conditions, but you do to really make my day that day. You're very, really, very great guys. I really appreciate you having the time and using your platform to bring awareness to my son's story. That's the most important part to me, is getting Daniel's story out there. Again, I want to lastly say also that also goes to other families. First thing you need to do, sometimes I get it, the news crew, for instance, my son, it took me 3 months just to get my son's story out there. And then once the story went nationally, it'll last for a certain length of time, then the story changed. You know, the narrative, things have to change. They have to go through different things. One thing is you have to create that platform for yourself. And I have to be my own media. So one of the things I'm really grateful for you guys sharing your platform to continue to have Daniel's story out there. And also for those families, they need to create things like a YouTube channel to make sure their loved one's story stay out there. You got to do everything you can to make sure that happens.
Yep, and this platform is here for you whenever you have an update, whenever you want to come back on to, you know, if there's some information that is new or developing, anything that you feel can help. If you have a search coming up or anything, just let us know. Anytime you're in need of that, you're more than welcome to come back on, and as long-winded as you need to be. You got all there.
Yeah, I get that. Yes.
It's all good.